The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today's topic hopefully is a wise topic and wisely discussed. It's a topic which I feel some inadequacy in addressing well, but I think it's a topic that is good to bring up for all of our reflection and to find our way. And it's related to the idea that is now fairly prominent in, periodically becomes very prominent in the national news, international news, and it has to do with clergy misconduct. And oftentimes what gets the highest to the news is often sexual misconduct of some kind or other. And this seems to be quite a recurrent phenomena, so much so that some people have serious doubts about the wisdom of organized religions and those kinds of roles and positions and what they're about. The reason to bring this up today is over the last few months, there have been allegations, fairly serious allegations of the sexual misconduct by a teacher in our wider Insight Meditation movement. And that has kind of came to kind of a head over this last weekend. It's not big enough for national news, only because our Insight movement is kind of small fry in the big national stage of religions. But it has made it into some of the national Buddhist publications, this person's, they alleged misconduct that that persons, someone, people have complained about. And it's really the, as far as I could tell, the first time in the 40-year history of the Insight movement, this kind of wide Vipassana movement that we're part of, where this has occurred at this kind of prominence and this level. And in doing that, we have joined the ranks of all religions, all denominations. And the only silver lining in this is that it may be more difficult to have the conceit that we're ethically better than other people or something. But it's very unfortunate, and it certainly involves a lot of suffering, and it warrants some discussion. And the way that I would like to discuss this is, I don't know if indirectly is the right word, but I actually don't want to talk about the particular person or the particular events of this, but I want to talk about a little bit more from a distance in other ways. It's not the first time this is kind of thing has happened in the Buddhist world in the United States. I've had, earlier in my life in the 1980s, I was involved with one Buddhist organization that was one of the more prominent ones that had an ethical scandal with its teacher, its abbot. So I witnessed the community and go through such things. And there was a lot of reflection and observations that I had. And so I thought I might share some of this with you and see if that can contribute to our overall wisdom and care around these issues as a community. The history of the convert Buddhism in the United States, meaning that we kind of in some big way began in a popular large-scale way in the mid to late 1960s and 1970s. And a lot of the people who were part of that counterculture back then were the people who came into this movement. And they came with often with great zeal and enthusiasm. But the ethical scandals, ethical challenges among some of the teachers began almost at the same time in the 1960s, started early on. Early on, it was a little bit hard for people to know how to respond and deal with and work with because of, there was no governance, there was no one, it was kind of like the the Wild West of Buddhism back then in terms of teachers and what they could do and who they were. But it all kind of came to a certain head in the 1980s. Probably the 1980s, there were a lot of ethical scandals with Buddhist teachers in the United States. And it wasn't just Buddhist teachers, but a lot of these imported religions that came to the West from Asia. Various Indian teachers who came here, their behavior came prominent, and there was a variety of different, I don't know if scandals is the right word to keep using, but, you know, challenges these communities came up with, and all kinds of things were addressed. By the late 80s and the early 90s, began to be a serious a degree of self-reflection on the part of many communities and begin looking at ethics and looking at what kind of ethical codes, what kind of ethical procedures, what kind of ethical organizations need to be in place to safeguard these communities from this kind of behavior that happened. And one of the leaders for this was actually Jack Kornfield. And he was really prominent in leadership and investigation and looking and trying to understand. And not only he spent time looking deeply into some of the allegations that happened at that time. And one instance, he actually flew to India all the way to India only to sit down and talk with a teacher, a Buddhist teacher in India, about his behavior and what had happened. And then flew all the way back because, you know, he really wanted to deal with this in a responsible way. He also went around surveyed and interviewed a whole bunch of the, I think, mostly Asian teachers. Teachers of Asian Buddhism, both Asian and Western teachers teaching in the United States, to talk about a variety of aspects of their personal lives, and particularly their sexual lives. And he wrote an article back in the 1980s called Sex Lives of the Gurus. That's still available. In fact, he published it in a recent anthology of some of his writings, and you can read it there. And some of the things, he says about the answers to his surveys about the sex lives of gurus will be surprising to some of you. Certainly surprising to me when I saw it. So before I continue on this topic, I want to teach you a practitioner's test, kind of a test that is, I don't know if it's actually literally given to practitioners, but I've sometimes, you know, given talks about using this example. And this is, imagine that, we're sitting here peacefully meditating and the Buddha comes to visit. He comes in and he sits down and he says to all of us, I made a mistake. Everything I taught is wrong. You should forget it. The Buddha says that. So that's the test. What would you do hearing that? Now I'll tell you what the hoped for answer is. And that is that you know something so well for yourself through your own experience, your own actions, the consequences. You know something so well for yourself that it doesn't matter if the Buddha says forget it. You know. You're not dependent on the Buddha to teach you something, but you know it for yourself. And even back in the Buddha's time, in his teaching, he talked about the goal of practice is for people to become independent in the Dharma. One Zen teacher I studied with in Japan talked about what it took to get back in Zen tradition called Dharma transmission, when you get authorized to be a independent Zen teacher. I asked him, what does it take? And he said, when you can stand on your own two feet in the Dharma. So be self-reliant in yourself. So you know it for yourself so well that you can find your way by yourself in some way. So that, I think those are wonderful ideas, becoming independent of Dharma and be able to stand on your own feet and be self-reliant. And then we would expect that the people who are the teachers, who are supposed to be the models of this, and maybe the most, some of the most mature people in the practice, that they are reliable, that they can stand independent of Dharma and live an ethically reliable life. And unfortunately, this has not always been the case. And there's been plenty of examples of suffering that's been caused. Certainly confusion's been caused by this. Now, when I was at San Francisco, when I was at the Zen Center, there was something called the six-month rule, which is instructive. And the six-month rule is that if someone has come to the Zen Center and is there for the first 6 months of their practice, and they're brand-new practitioners, no one who's been there longer is supposed to get romantically involved with them. They're supposed to leave them alone. And the reason for that is that they want people to have a chance to settle into the practice, learn the practice for themselves, so it becomes personal, becomes their own in some way, and doesn't get confused with a romantic relationship in the center. And because romantic relationships, there's a certain percentage of them that don't work out so well. And so, if they don't work out, then it can be, because of the confusion between the practice and the relationship, then the people not only sour in the relationship, but they'll sour with the practice. And the idea is to safeguard people in the practice by letting them develop their own connection, personal connection to it. Whether people can do that in 6 months, whether that's long enough, I don't know. But it is kind of important in these kind of practice areas. Like if you go to some Buddhist monasteries here in the West where that are co-ed, they're like, I don't know what the right language is, but like romance central. There's something about people doing monastic life, doing a lot of meditation, being very open, very tender, very vulnerable. People are kind of a little bit, they're kind of in the environment of purity, the environment of spirituality that touches people in some deep inner way. And, it's easy to kind of, fall in love with people. But it's not really the person that some people are falling in love with, but rather some of the qualities of the practice or the Dharma that are coming through them. And not a few people have, in that kind of environment, have fallen in love only to find out later that that's not quite what the person is or was or something. And so a little bit surprised. And so that environment, it's easy to fall in love with and or confuse spirituality with romance in such a way that things get confused. And I think that's part of one of the reasons why often some of these ethical difficulties with teachers arise is because it's so easy to confuse these two worlds, the sense of intimacy, the sense of the open heart, the sense of being connected to someone, being seen in a deep way by someone that, for many people, that only happens in romantic relationships, and so it kind of overlaps and people get confused and things like that. The other thing that happens that can contribute to these difficulties is practitioners and teachers live in a very powerful field of projection, idealism, transference, all these kind of psychological kind of phenomena. And there's often a desire to idealize teachers, to hold them up on a pedestal, to see them as being all good or all wonderful or all enlightened. And because the teachers represent something very powerful, a powerful wish, powerful need, powerful reference point. And so there's a lot of idealization that goes on. A common expression, I think, in many religions, not just Buddhism, for clergy, people in the kind of teacher role, clergy role, is that they are screens for projection. And there's a lot of it. And projection is not necessarily bad. Some of it has a very important role, and some of it can be considered healthy. I mean, you know, probably if there was no projection ever, no one would ever get married or something like that, you know. I mean, these things, you know, it's part and parcel of our lives, you know, and what goes on. And it's not necessarily bad, but in spiritual circles, sometimes it can be helpful even within degree, especially if the teacher knows how to keep strong boundaries and knows how to behave properly. But the projections on a teacher, idealism of teachers, think the teacher is really just the perfect embodiment of wisdom or enlightenment or Buddhahood or something. And then the unfortunate thing is if people look at teachers with those eyes or come and say, you know, wonderful things and to the teacher. And what I've seen in my years as a teacher is that the people who like a teacher, like their talks or like their teachings or like something, they're the ones who come and speak to the teacher. There's a higher percentage of them that come to speak to the teacher. Oh, that was so great. You're so great. And the people think, this guy's crazy. I can't believe this person said it. It doesn't make any sense. It's not right. All kinds of things. They just quietly leave more often than not. So teachers don't receive a balanced news, a balanced reflection back of who they are. And so, you know, it's very easy then after a while, like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm kind of special. I kind of suspected, but now there's proof. And so not only is the idealization from people listening to the teacher, but then the teacher becomes to idealize themselves, and that becomes a kind of a blind spot, and then they don't see themselves fully, or it's easy to excuse the teacher's behavior because they're all-knowing, they must have great wisdom. And in fact, we find in some Buddhist traditions, some Buddhist situations where the teacher is kind of explicitly said to represent the Buddha or to be the Buddha, and they'll say, you know, I know what you need. I know what your practice needs, and that is a sexual relationship. So that seems like a tremendous abuse of power, of idealization, of some of the projections that go on. And then the projections can go in all kinds of directions. And sometimes the more extreme the projection of the teacher is idealized and seems to be all good, it's very most likely the pendulum will swing. And at some point the teacher is all bad and terrible and all that. So all these kind of very deep dynamics are going on. And some of them arise out of people's deep psychological needs, both that for the practitioner, but also sometimes the teacher has deep psychological needs or wounds or undeveloped aspects of themselves that go on. And so these all get entangled in the whole complexity of it all. And because of that, it can create much more harm when people, there are unethical things being done. One of the things that quickly became apparent in the late 1980s among the people who were looking into teacher misconduct was the dangers of isolation. And teachers who are isolated from peers or friends and are sitting at the top of the hierarchy with all their students, they still have their emotional needs, social needs in play, need them, but then they get played out sometimes in dysfunctional ways with the people who they're seeing all the time. But if they have a peer group outside or inside, that's much healthier. And so that's one of the reasons why historically in the Insight movement, there was a big emphasis on teaching retreats, for example, with co-teachers. And some of the retreats actually have many teachers, some bit larger retreats have had six teachers present, but often two teachers teaching. And that's a little bit to mitigate some of the challenges of being an isolated single teacher and you're there with a peer and there's different people that are reflecting and seeing what's going on. And there are some teachers who break ethical norms, guidelines, from feelings of entitlement, as an assertion of their power, sometimes their dominance. And it's very unhealthy what goes on. Sometimes it's simply, they are caught up in their greed or desire for pleasure or for all kinds of things. And there are some teachers who cross the line of sexual misconduct or other ethical misconduct because they are struggling with their own needs or they're unresolved in their own needs or they're trying to somehow resolve their own suffering in dysfunctional ways. But they're not necessarily being intentionally harmful or want to harm anyone, but there's their own confusion that comes out and plays out in the whole thing. So what I've seen over these years is when there's been a major ethical breach by a teacher, that it can create huge degrees of suffering for a community and for practitioners. But sometimes it's not only that. Sometimes it has benefits as well. So there are people who feel deeply betrayed, and people who are relying on the teacher as a model for behavior that, for example, if someone is alcoholic and is just barely holding on to sobriety, and it helps to know that your sponsor, your support, your teachers, or someone, is a safe place to go. And but if you find out that your teacher is drinking heavily, and then that reference point, that kind of life-saving kind of place you're holding on to for dear life, that is not there, and people can feel hurt, betrayed, confused. And that can happen in all kinds of ways. The people come to Buddhism with all kinds of terrible backgrounds, lots of suffering, and not a few people. I mean, a lot of people in our society have had sexual trauma, sexual suffering they've had. And so they kind of come with that, and they're also maybe holding on for dear life or trying to open up or to deal with something that's been hard for them to even address for themselves. And then kind of the person who was supposed to represent a way forward to find healing or do something is involved in ethical misconduct, sexual misconduct. That can be, put person way back, or they feel betrayed, or that something deep inside shuts down again. So the sense of betrayal is sometimes huge, a sense of pain, sense of how people shut down. I've known people who have shut down so much, they had a kind of a inclination or strong motivation to practice, and they kind of shut it off and spent years doing something else, and then maybe slowly came back to some place, kind of tested the waters, is this really a safe place, is this okay, and maybe kind of found a place that became their home again, but it took years before they are ready for that. Sometimes it's been quite good for some people. I'm not justifying at all the behavior, but sometimes the scandals have popped the idealization that people had, and so suddenly they woke up and looked and be able to see more clearly what's happening, and rather than seeing through the lens of their idealization or their projection, some people realize that partly because of that and for other reasons that it was time for them to grow up. That they were relying too much. They were maybe a little bit of a dependency relationship to the whole thing, maybe even an infantile relationship to a center, to a teacher and all that. That person was going to make all the decisions for them, was going to guide their lives, do all kinds of things. And then they realized, wait a minute, I have to now do this for myself. I have to stand on my own two feet. I have to make a decision. I have to grow up. I have to speak up. I have to learn to stand firm. And some people I've seen, people become stronger. I've seen people learn to stand in the fire of difficulties they hadn't known how to do before. I've seen people then use these occasions to really look deeply at their own conditionings, their own background, where they try to understand why they were triggered so much, why they had such a strong reaction to it, why it was so painful for them when their teacher and their community had some kind of problem. And I've seen people grow dramatically by being forced to really look more deeply into themselves than they'd ever seen or ever kind of taken the time to do in their beliefs, in their unresolved areas. There's one of the, a few times in my, 40 some years of Buddhist practice, I've had to, I couldn't find a different word than the word confront. I don't quite think that's the right word. I looked for synonyms for the word, and all the synonyms were wrong. Stand my ground wasn't quite either. But I had to stand my ground unflinchingly, kind of, and question and challenge or engage in and push against certain ones of my teachers because of their conduct. And really had to stay there until they were able to go, to work through it and find a way through. Those conversations were kind of a milestone for me, or turning point, or important kind of part of my own growth, that people who I'd idealized and held up as being, when I was a new student, for example, people who were I was a brand new student and they were the great teachers. And then 20 years later, I had to kind of stand there and say, look, you can't just slip around this. We have to deal with this and look at it and hold them to be accountable. That was, quite a moment, at least for me personally, to have that strength and that ability and come to that. So I've seen a variety of things that how people have dealt with this. And I've seen a variety of ways in which teachers have dealt with these things. I've seen teachers who have been in denial, teachers who have pushed everything away and are incapable of being in conversation. I have seen teachers who then have left their centers and were not willing to be in conversation dialogue, who blamed everyone else, and that problem was there. And then they just opened up shop somewhere else, because you can do that. Just go to another city, another country, I've seen people do, and they just open up shop and, continue. And seemingly, some of them maybe learned a little bit from what happened, and some of them, I wonder if they ever learned anything at all from it. Unfortunately, it's too easy, I think, in all areas, in many of the Buddhist countries, but especially here in the United States, to be a self-made teacher, to teach without any reference point to a community, to an organization, and people to hold you accountable. And so then these difficulties can just, you move to another place. In the Catholic Church, the problem has been that they move people to other dioceses. And that seems pretty awful, just to move the problem somewhere else. But there's no diocese in America. There's just these, you can set yourself up independently, and there's no... So I've been on the ethics committee of Spirit Rock for many years, and there's not many, ethics committees in Buddhist circles, but Spirit Rock has a certain national prominence. And so we would receive phone calls or contact from people in other Buddhist communities completely unrelated to us, that they had no way of dealing with these problems, and they were calling for us to somehow intervene or do something. And that was very hard, because we had no authority there. And without authority, without being invited in, it's very hard to step in. And it takes a lot of time. And who has the time for all the ethical issues that exist in America? So it's hard enough to take care of it sometimes in our scene. And then I've seen some teachers who have really taken things to heart, who really felt deep remorse, really used this as a time to take a break, go into therapy, go into recovery, go into all kinds of things in order to really kind of get to the bottom of what was going on for them, and then to look about how to go forward in healthy ways. So I've seen some teachers who said they were going to do those things and then were still not capable of doing it. And so I've seen teachers who said they were going to do it and the community was ready to kind of accept that, but then when they couldn't do it, then it was understood and things went on from there. The person had to leave. So I wanted to say this. You know, this fits into under the category of ethics, and I think from a Buddhist point of view, ethics is defined by the two things: by the behavior that we do, that we act on, that causes harm, or the opposite, causes benefits, and then the study of ethics has to do with looking at the values that underlie the choices about the behavior that causes harm or not harm, and looking at those values. And in terms of what I've seen over these years with ethics, especially sexual ethics and sexual transgressions, is that communities can have a variety of responses. And some of this, I remember Jack Kornfield once recounting three stages in the insight meditation movement's response to sexual impropriety by some of the teachers. And I don't know how, you know, this was his account, I don't know quite, you know, what he was referring to. But he said the first approach to deal with these things was denial. So that's a good one. The second one is was excommunication. So it's just very hard and sharp, like you're out of here, you're done, just boom. And the third phase was dialogue. Third stage was to really to go into the whole thing and explore it, find out what was going on, and be in dialogue. And when I was, so I've been involved in these ethical issues for I guess 25 years in trying to respond to all these, and involved in different ethics committees, and also involved in writing documents, ethical documents for some of these Buddhist communities. And and trying to understand how the wisest way to go forward. And what I've come to so far, this date, is that how important it is to be involved in dialogue, how important it is to open into conversation, and how important it is not to succumb to a lot of the usual instincts that people have of of hard and fast punishment, blame, hard and fast right and wrong, which can lend itself to, a lot of this lends itself to a certain kind of hysteria. Even though I'm very motivated to try to move people into communities and people into a more ethical life, sometimes the reaction to these things have been too extreme. It's like the pendulum swings too far, and they almost cause harm in the kind of puritanicalism in response to ethical transgressions. So what are the values for dealing with tension, conflict, ethical transgressions that that might come through and we have to deal with? So what I'd like to do is to read to you a document that is describes the approach here at IMC. This is found on our website, and it's getting revisited over this last year, and there's now a committee involved to update it. It's, you know, about 20 years old, so these things, our understanding of these things changes, so this will be revised, hopefully, by the end of the year or so. But this conveys some of the values which maybe are a little bit different than the values that are instinctual among some people or some places in our society. So here's what it says. Conflicts will inevitably arise within the IMC community. The health of our community is not measured by the presence or absence of conflict, rather by our willingness to find effective, responsible, and compassionate resolution of interpersonal tensions when they arise. The intention is to attend to and learn from conflict. The intention to attend to and learn from conflict is a clear application of Buddhist practice in our daily lives. Without this intention, practice can become simply a comfort rather than a deeply transformative vehicle for our lives. So that's all these are important sentences, but this last one, that many people want to be comfortable and rather than really look deeply at some of the difficult areas of personal and our collective lives. So without this intention to really attend and learn from conflict, practice can be simply a comfort rather than a deep transformative vehicle for our lives. Buddhist conflict resolution is not based on right or wrong, blame or guilt, winning or losing, offenders or victims. I think that's a very powerful statement. And certainly can be difficult, and some people might actually feel hurt just hearing this because they've been hurt so deeply and these ideas are so integral to them trying to understand it and cope with how they've been hurt and things like that, that this can seem almost can be difficult to hear. But this is not to belittle anybody's suffering or anybody's circumstances, but it's just saying maybe there's another approach than right or wrong, blame or guilt, winning or losing, offenders or victims. So rather, Buddhist conflict resolution is based on addressing the suffering of all concerned. Hurt, fear, and anger are taken seriously through forums where everyone may speak honestly, safely, and completely about their own direct experiences and feelings. In seeking resolution, Buddhist practice values dialogue over silence, reconciliation over estrangement, forgiveness over resentment, confession over accusation, and atonement over punishment. And then, because the process of reaching such a resolution is often difficult, IMC has an ethics council that offers support for that when it arises. So the idea, at the heart of all this is the idea of dialogue and discussion, and a willingness to do so in a productive, clear, engaged way, and which is not always the case. So some people are not able to do it. Some people it's quite difficult to do. Some people succumb to blame. Some people will use wonderful language of talking about forgiveness and compassion and wisdom, and then turn around and blame people, even so. And some people will take responsibility for certain aspects of their behavior, but are incapable of taking responsibility for their core aspects because they don't see it. They don't know it, what they're doing, and kind of invisible to them. So this whole field is a difficult one. But if we can make the practice our own, if we've discovered how to touch into our own capacity for mindfulness, our own capacity for liberation and freedom to some degree, our own way of learning to let go of and to have compassion and care for ourselves, then I think it becomes, with time, more natural for us to be able to come forward and stand in the fire and be able to have some of these difficult conversations that need to happen. And that's true for Buddhist communities that go through this kind of stuff. The whole communities sometimes need to go through this, not just individuals. And it's a difficult process, but in the end, it's a process that I think can be done in such a way that everyone benefits from it, becomes better because of it. So those are my thoughts. And if some of you have some concerns about anything that I've said today, or probably this is not the day to praise me for this talk. Yeah. But if you have criticism for it, it's welcome. This is the day for it. Anyway, if you have questions or concerns you want to raise about what I've talked about, you're welcome to come up here afterwards. So, thank you.